we're surrounded by stories that just don't add up. Choices that appear to be baffling, actions that defy logic. But what if there's more to the story? On How Did It Make Sense, we explore the power of learning from experience and digging into the second stories that are always present. We talk to experts from diverse fields who are challenging the way we think about safety, risk, and decision making. Join us as we unlock the lessons hidden within everyday events. Some of these are high risk and some appear to be mundane, but all of them show how we can create a fairer, safer, and more resilient world. Welcome to another episode of How Did It Make Sense from Human in the System? And the purpose of these podcasts is to dig into the local rationality of people involved in events. It doesn't have to be high risk. It could be a corporate space. It could be an adventurous sports situation. But ultimately, people have got some understanding, some practice of how it made sense for them to do what they did. People are not going out there to harm themselves intentionally in normal work or normal adventure sports. So when things go wrong, we often jump to those conclusions, and that's the first story. What we want to do is dig into that second story that explains that. And we've got David, Newview safety coach from Australia, to talk about, start off with himself, who he is and how he got to where he is, and then we'll come on to some storytelling. So David, spill the beans. Who are you? What do you do? And where can people find you?
Well, it's going to be a brief story, although I am old. Older than I want to be anyway. Originally from the northeast of England, moved over to Australia nearly 20 years ago and changed a lot of work that I had been doing back in England. In England, I was an account manager, sales exec, and all that kind of office-based stuff to try and keep out of the cold. When I came to Australia, I went, let's get outdoors. Let's go and do some different work. I don't want to be stuck in an office. I want to take advantage of the outdoors, which turned out to be a bit of a revolutionary ambition of mine, really, because I ended up doing some of the craziest. I was basically backpacking around Australia for 2 years, which a lot of English people do. But I ended up doing some great work in some great places with some amazing people in terrifying situations. I ended up, before I gave up all that backpacking, ended up mustering cattle on a million acre station, sleeping out of a swag for 3 months. Essentially sleeping out of a sleeping bag out in the open. You have to put your sleeping bag, your swag, as we call it, because it's a bit like a wax jacket.
Roll mat, wasn't it? Yeah.
Roll mat, wax jacket, roll mat type stuff. You have to put it in the tree during the day so the snakes and the spiders don't get into it when you unroll it at night. And I'm like, but snakes can climb trees. And they're like, shush now, don't worry about that. It's all good. It's all good. So I was like, oh, okay. No worries. And so I was there for a season, or was it a season and a half? And I probably slept in a bed for about 4 or 5 nights. The rest of the time was out.
Wow.
Because you basically pack.
Move with the cattle.
You basically move with the cattle. And the cattle, it's a million acres. It's probably the size of Wales. And you go into different watering holes and you're building the holding pens and you're doing all that stuff.
Oh, right.
Anyway. Yeah, no, and then you, I suppose you're inoculating the
risk
cows.
And uncertainty.
Oh, mate, I forgot my water, because there was the rule, you had to have what's called a camelback, which is essentially a portable water bottle
you
keep on your back of like 5 or 6 litres. A lot of people who bike and mountain climb and stuff like that will know about it in England, but I forgot that once, and it was the golden rule, you had to have it on you the whole time. I forgot it once, and I lasted about an hour and a half, and that was it. I was on death door, and I'm like, I'm never forgetting that again. So anyway, I did that, and then I thought, well, I quite like Australia. So I sold my house back in the UK, started studying, found a job, found several jobs, set up several companies, and then everything over here in WA is based on the mining and resources industry. And when that collapses and expands like it does cyclically, really, mm-hmm. I mean, like, you can almost predict when it's going to be expanding and contracting, especially with outside influences from China and other places like that. I saw that coming in the horizon. I thought, okay, well, let's get out of that. Let's get into something stable. I had a wife and, you know, such forth and mortgage and all those kind of things that everyone has. So I wanted to get out because I was in that. Let's get out of that. And I ended up in local government. And I was there for a while, moving around, doing lots of great stuff. And they said, look, we've never had a safety guy in the city. Do you want to set up the very first safety lead role and build the safety management system for the city? And I went, wow, I've never worked in safety. That sounds interesting. Let's go and do that. So that's how I got into safety. and that was
wow.
10, yeah, that was 10 odd years ago. And I always tell the story because it's kind of like my reckoning, really. So I didn't know what I was doing. So I reached out to people all over WA who were in the same position I was but had experience. And I said, let's form groups. I like forming groups. I like getting people together and collaborating and talking and sharing knowledge and information. Let's get a group together and let's – how long am I waffling on? I always do this. I apologize. That's what my channel's called. The Shut Up David series for a reason because I can waffle on. Anyway, I set up this group of people and I built what I thought was a good safety management system. Turns out, after I did it all and rolled it all out and thought I was the king of the castle, an ex-work colleague of mine comes up to me and goes, yeah, well done, David. You've not improved anything for us and you've just made our work harder. And I went, oh, he's right. I've protected the officers, PCBU, as we term it now here in Australia, but I've not actually improved anything at the front end. And I thought, well, I don't know what to do. I need to get out of safety because this is just demoralizing. I can't do this. And it makes sense what he's saying. And then I found Sydney Decker, Safety Differently, New View Safety. It was kind of like an enlightenment through like punishment, really. It was kind of like you're going to walk through this door into this big wide world and it's just going to be chaos and mayhem. That's Decker for you. But I did, and I went and did the postgrad degree with him. And then ever since then, I've just been focusing on areas which are of interest to me. And to cut a long story short, I really resonate.
What's going to be longer than this?
I know. Apologize. I'll try and keep it short. Human psychology and organizational coaching and how they come together to benefit safety. So that's me.
Awesome.
I've got a channel just like yourself and called New View Safety Coach. And I do lots of blogs and posts and all that kind of stuff. But you
that's
already
cool
know
stuff.
That.
Yeah. Well, right. I do.
You've been on my YouTube channel, and you've been a guest.
We'll put the links in the show notes for this, both in the podcast and on the YouTube. So that's really cool. This is all about telling stories, first stories and second stories. So what's the first story in sort of safety parlance, rather than first, as in there's more than one? So this is just one story, but tell it from that first story perspective. Go for it.
Gotcha. All right. So to set a little bit of the context as well, I'm out of local government. I'm working for a boutique consultancy firm here in Perth as a senior safety consultant. I was there for several years. And as part of that job, we get sent out to go and do incident investigations for different organizations. I'm saying this for two reasons. I didn't work for the organization. I want to try and keep it as sterile as possible because it's an actual situation. And if I'm too specific, then people will be able to put the pieces together with where I've worked and all that kind of stuff. So the situation was I got the call from the boss saying there is a power station in Western Australia.
A town.
Keep the innocent and the guilty protected. There's a power station in WA and they want you to go out there and be lead investigator for an ICAM investigation for an active edge, which is in scaffolding term is, because it's a scaffolding incident, is someone on scaffolding and the barrier is missing and they are not connected to a solid point in the scaffolding. So I'm like, oh, okay.
So working at height without sort of effective fall protection in place and barrier protection.
Essentially, yep, but on scaffolding. So I was like, oh, okay, well, it sounds fairly simple, to be honest with you, but okay, let's go and have a look. So I took another guy from the organization. I was lead investigator. I was supposedly, anyway, lead investigator. And we went to the power station and we went and said, okay, well, you know, we're here, what's going on? And it turned out that we were there because the prime who owned the power station has a lot of contractors in there, and the contractors were the scaffolders. This situation had happened, and neither of them could figure out or come to a conclusion or come to an agreement. So they wanted to get an independent arbitrator in to come and do an instant investigation for them. Okay, cool. No worries. Talk me through. Let's go and have a look at what happened. So we go out there, and they start explaining. The prime starts explaining that there's a building, and there's a building here which we're decommissioning on site over the next 10 years. So the scaffolding is up for a long time. There's an active drop zone over there, and it's actually cordoned off, so it's semi-permanent. So there's always fence grip around it and all that kind of stuff. And a scaffolder was seen on the third level with an active edge, and he wasn't connected to scaffolding, and we want to get rid of him. So I'm like, okay, well, that's the first story. He was breaking the rule. I mean, he was breaking the rule. He was breaking the rule. He should have been connected to the scaffolding. He wasn't. It's a life-saving rule, as we call it here in Australia. I don't know about the UK as well. He broke all the rules. And, basically they were...
And as a consequence, he should be out of here.
Yep.
So as with all of the, you know, the episodes we've got on this series, that there's always more to it than that. And I think that's, you know, the sort of prime goal of this is to encourage the listeners to ask that question, how did it make sense for that situation and for those involved to do what they did? Not just the sharp end workers who we're talking about, but potentially there's organizationally, you know, why did the organization behave the way it does? So tell us the second story or second stories that contribute to this event then, David.
Okay. So can I share my screen? I can share my screen, can't I?
Yeah, you should be able to share your screen.
Let's see if I can. Okay. So for those people who aren't familiar with scaffolding, this isn't the site I'm about to show you. This is just a random image that was found on Google. However, it does quite closely represent the situation that I was at, except it was in the power station, so there's a lot more surrounding buildings. So I just want to show people what we're
talking about. Now here. Yep.
So we've got a central structure and it's surrounded by scaffolding. This one's a bit messier and stuff like that. But you're looking at it and straight away, tell me within 5 seconds where all the active edges are.
Well, there's only one that I can easily see, which is this deck, first solid deck, just above there. There's bars going left and right, but where your hand is in the mouse position. Yep. So that's where I see an active edge there, where there's no, in effect, barrier protection.
There's another one here. There's no barrier at that level. There's another one here. That bar's broken there. There's several on there, but the point I'm trying to make here by showing this image is that scaffolding is not the easiest thing to look at straight away.
Yeah.
Because there's so many horizontal lines and depth perception can skew people's perception of what they're looking at. Now, okay, the reason I wanted to say that was, so we get to site, he's showing us around. I'm finding it difficult to actually see where this active edge is. Due to the structures of what's going on and the dimensions, because there's another building behind it that also had scaffolding on it. So I was finding it difficult and I was like, oh, so it's, and I was actually looking at the wrong floor for about half an hour while he's talking, going, what's going on here? And all this kind of stuff. Okay. So we've got that scene set with me being on site and looking at it, and not even knowing what the hell is going on. So we start down this investigation and I start talking to the people and go, okay, well, talk me through exactly what happened. They said, the primes had, as we mentioned, the contractor, he went through a gate. He went through a gate at the bottom of the scaffolding, which says that you must be connected whenever around active edges. He went up, and then he was operating close to an active edge. Okay. Cool. No worries. Tell me more, because that's not all there is to it. Well, he didn't turn up for the pre-start. He was late for the pre-start. And everybody else was already on the job site when he rocked up. And what they were doing, they were dismantling parts of the scaffold above them that were going to be taken down. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
No worries. So why was he late? Oh, we don't know. He's been late. He's been flaky. He's been off his game for the past month or two. We don't really know why. Yeah. We don't really care, to be honest with you. He's a contractor. He's not really performing. Let's get rid of him. Oh, okay. Let's go and talk to the contractor. Let's go and have an interview with this guy and get him to show us and talk about what his situation is. Okay. So here's the second story. He had twins a month and a half ago, brand new twins. His sleep pattern is off the chart tired, right?
Yeah.
He missed the pre-start because his wife was calling him because she was taking one of the twins to hospital because it had colic or some kind of cough or something on those lines. He didn't go home. He stayed at work because that was his obligation to do.
Yeah,
he went through the gate. Now, bearing in mind, he went through the gate. The work that he was supposed to be doing would not have created any active edges. He wasn't expecting any active edges. Okay? He knows it's a goal. Well, yeah. It's a... Oh, but it gets worse. It gets worse. So...
Or better.
Or better, whichever side you're on. So he goes up. Their job is they're dismantling scaffolding from one level, as I said, to take it down to the next level because the prime needs to be doing work or something on those lines. Now, the prime and these scaffolding guys, they never do any work on the infrastructure. They never do any mechanical work. They're just there as scaffolders. So he goes up. He sees his boys, his crew that they always work with. He sees that they are working. Because he's flustered and he's come to site, he's tired, and he's also flustered because he's late for work. He doesn't quite notice that they're all hooked up. He doesn't see that because they're busy doing things and passing scaffolding around from one level to the next. They're doing things. As he's walking towards his supervisor, who is within 5 meters of this active edge and hooked up, to ask him what he wants to do, the prime just happens to be walking around with the senior management and sees this individual within 5 meters of an active edge, blows the whistle, stops the job, pulls everybody down, says they want him off site. Okay, no worries. So he's pulled down, he's off site. We're there about a week later, to be honest with you. There's been so much going on in the meantime. But when we sit down and have a chat with this guy and say, well, why weren't you hooked up? He says, well, we weren't expecting an active edge. Okay, well, why weren't you expecting an active edge? Because there isn't usually one there. Okay. So then we went back and said, why is there an active edge? And they said, oh, we don't know why there's an active edge. What exactly do you mean you don't know there's an active edge? The scaffolders didn't make an active edge. They got up on site, not expecting one, found one, hooked up. Why was there an active edge? Turns out the prime guys who'd been up there maintaining took scaffolding away from their scaffolding structure so they could throw debris off into the drop zone and below. And they never put the active edge back. This is a recurring theme. They were doing this all over the place. But and the crew got up there, saw it, and they hooked up. It just so happens that our friend didn't see it and didn't hook up, and the senior management saw him at the last minute. Now, he was still fired from the site. They decided that they didn't want anybody who wasn't hooked up because they didn't see the scaffolding. and he'd been late a few times because he'd had tw they didn't know he'd had twins, but he'd had twins. They didn't care, to be honest with you. I'm sure I've missed a few things out in that, but the
That
complexity of
was
the
sort of bit. Then I
story,
can see, yeah.
the whole
It's
complexity of the
to me that
story
the.
is more around the individual. It's around the prime not controlling their environment and then blaming contractors and subcontractors for the results of their actions and not taking that into
Yeah,
account.
the bit that I get from here is what's the message that that shares, that sends to anybody else? And you sit there and go, right, we as organizations, they want to create the environment where you find out those gaps, no pun intended, in that situation. And you sit there and go, if you're in a situation, wrong place, wrong time, get caught out. And a question I would ask is, what did the contractors do with the disassembled scaffolding when they came back in? Did they then rebuild it to make it safe? And you'd sit there and go, is that able to be fed back into the prime to sit there and go, you know what, on a regular basis, we're having to rebuild this. And it might be that their supervisors don't know that these modifications are happening to the operational space that's going on and the risks that are there. And one of your fellow
That
countrymen,
was
Clive Lloyd, of you can't fix a secret.
exactly no, and you hit the nail on the head there. The prime wasn't aware that the scaffolders would regularly go up and need to make modifications to the scaffolding or reapply scaffolding because the prime employers had removed and not put it back. So
Modified
that
it,
was
yeah.
number one. They'd essentially modified it, and when the crew got up there, because they were working to a tight deadline, they didn't have time to reapply that scaffolding in order to do it. So they all just said, let's hook up. We don't have to move very far. We're only moving from one level to the next. As soon as we get it all on the deck, we'll unhook. Well, we won't unhook, but we'll make the site safe again.
Yeah.
And then we can all unhook. It wasn't a big deal. I mean, these guys have been in the scaffolding for 20 years. They know what they're doing. They know if they need to move or not. It's just our mate who comes in was completely unaware of all of this because of his personal situation that went on. In talking to his friends, though, during interviewing, because we interviewed all the scaffolders that were involved in that, obviously, interviewed, we, I
Yeah.
mean, that's the first thing that we said when we
Conversations.
come in. Yeah, we had a conversation, and that was the thing. We'd write it up on the whiteboard. This is one thing that I implemented in my second role after I was told that I hadn't done anything effective, was I changed the name of incident investigations to learning opportunities. And we got the people
Yeah.
into the boardroom. It was all very official, but I wanted to make them feel comfortable. And up on the whiteboard, I wrote incident investigation, crossed that out, and said, no,
Scored it
this
M.
is a learning
Awesome.
opportunity, learning opportunity. And the guy, every guy that came in would look and go, okay, but someone's still going to get
Yeah.
fired, aren't they? And I went, that's out of my control, but let's
Yeah.
see what we can learn from this. And it's weird, because so many people I've spoke to as well who've been involved in incidents and been responsible for incidents, like this guy was responsible, not really, but they blame themselves. And even his workmates blamed him. They said,
Yeah.
we know ev all the time if there's an active edge, we need to be hooked up. He should have done it. We always pull each other up, blah, blah. And I'm like, but did he see it? And they said, well, it was clear, it was obvious. But it was, even his own workmates couldn't change their mindset to appreciate that their workmate, who they'd worked with for 5 years, knew was newly married, knew just had kids, could potentially make an error of judgment where he didn't see that they were hooked up and there was an active edge.
You want to go and show
So
them
he's
some
not just,
invisible gorilla videos?
oh, I know, yeah. How many times have they passed the ball? It's
Yeah,
oh.
that's it. And so people just don't understand it as, what's the limit of our attention? And how you've described that, A, we're tired, we're stressed, so actually our visual tunnel is shrinking. And if he's on his way, this is me hypothesizing behaviors. This is, I'm on my way to supervisor, I'm late, I know I'm in the shit. Right, how do I, explain my situation? Right, I'm going to make eye contact with my boss. which means I'm here. We haven't expected to have an active edge anywhere. So that's me running my situation. So absolutely understanding our selective attention and the limitations. And the more stressed we are, the more tired we are, the more that we shrink things through. And we don't see what is obvious after the event.
And going back to your whole analogy of the video as well, for people who aren't aware, there was in Harvard University, I believe it was, there was this graduate psychologist who's going through and explaining, trying to find experiments which were actually very replicable in his sense, which is why it's become so famous. Yeah. We don't see as much as we think we see. And especially if our attention is focused on a particular task or object or sequence like a locus of attention, we eliminate so much around us. And what this guy did, just to fill in the blanks, he showed a video of two teams of basketball players, one in white, one in black. And the participant who was watching the video was told to watch the white team only, and count how many times they pass the ball between them. While they're doing that, and this is a video pre-recorded, obviously, on the right-hand side of the screen, near the black players, a guy in a gorilla suit would come on, do a dance, and then walk off. And then at the end of the recording, the participant was asked, did you see the guy in the gorilla suit on the same screen? And they're all 50% of them said, what are you talking about? Don't be stupid. They replayed it back and they said, I never saw a guy in the gorilla suit.
Yeah.
And that's because we
there's so many. Yeah.
No, sorry.
And we can frame that. So we can frame that. And there are a number of other videos. There's the amazing color, amazing card chain or color changing card trick, which is another piece on that. And so there's some audio involved in that one. And when I play that video, you know, there's only four changes, some of the background changes. But when I replay it, you can hear the background cover being dropped and you can hear the tablecloth being dropped. But when you're actually watching the video, you're not paying attention to it. Another one is the whodunit video. And I say to people, listen carefully to the story. Who did the murder? And now we've got audio and video channels, you know, in our brains, we're focusing on the audio channel. And if people, English isn't their first language, you know, I teach globally. If English isn't their first language, they pick hardly anything up. But when I taught a class in New Zealand, we didn't have the audio working on the big TV screen. And people picked up way more because now they're only looking at the video channel. You know, they're processing the video channel. So
we've only got limited bandwidth of cognitive capability, haven't we?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so those wider performance shaping factors of stress and fatigue and might be noise as well, that reduces our ability to pay attention to what's going on. And we've got to be really careful about that sort of punitive approach without understanding the local rationality of what's going on.
And it doesn't even really take much either. The same guy who came up with the gorilla experiment at Harvard University came up with the second experiment, which is also replicable and validated as well, which is Harvard University gets lots of tourists there. It's a beautiful building. It's a beautiful place. A lot of tourists go to have a look at it. So what he did, he got a student, supposed student, to go up to what looked like tourists with a map and asked them for help to get to a certain location on campus. While they're providing directions or while they're talking about it, some other people would walk in between them carrying a door, just a door. And it's a random thing, but it provided enough time to block view. Yeah. So the person that they were talking to was replaced with somebody else, sometimes completely different gender, different race, ethnicity, height, weight, all this kind of stuff. Again, only 50% of people picked up on that difference. There is no stress there. They're giving somebody help.
Yeah.
There is no time constraints. There's no job demands. There is no personal situation that's time critical.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they still didn't pick up on that change. It's a phenomenal.
It's really cool. And so what there's a similar one talking about a clown juggling in another sort of university courtyard. And they were looking at people using their phones, personal electronic devices. And what they found is that when you had two people then actually they detected this unicycling clown going round the courtyard. But when they were on their own, they didn't. So actually this bit about peer checking and looking out for each other, because the likelihood of both people being task loaded at the same time within the same sort of confines, then actually, you know, it's a really important piece is to understand that. And I've sort of talked on a previous podcast, I don't think you can develop a just culture in an organization if you don't accept and, you know, sort of take on board the variability, performance variability. You know, right, we're going to develop this just culture policy, this is what we're going to do, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, but people still make mistakes and we'll punish them for it. Well, yeah, it ain't going to happen. So, yeah. And that intelligence is there.
I had very similar conversations with Andy Schoen and Ian Collins about people latching on to this phrase now of learning teams. And learning teams are fabulous. Yeah. They're amazing. They're revolutionary. They're a great way for an organization to learn about this second story. What you can't just do, you can't have learning teams in just any organization unless you've been prepared to do the fundamental work to hear the noise, to hear the stories that are going to come to you. Because if you turn around as a senior leader and go, oh, those are fabulous, and we now know who to blame, and you're all gone, by the way, you're never going to get a second chance to learn anything else. And it sounds like it's very similar with regards to what you're talking about. You have to do the groundwork. You can't just implement these things willy-nilly because I've worked with one organization and they said, we want to know as much as we can. And we said to them, do you really? Do you really? Because you're going to hear a lot of stuff which you don't want to hear. And 90% of our work as consultants going in there wasn't dealing with the data that was coming back from the learning teams and such forth. It was working with the senior leaders and work in a coaching capacity and talking to them about the horrible things that they're hearing, and the deviation from norm, the work is done versus work is imagined, and how it made them feel as individuals and leaders of an organization, because their response, and I hate to use the hop terminology again, but their response matters so much, because it's either going to continue learning or you're going to completely stymie it again every single time.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I think there's one of the bits that was brought up to me recently when I was talking about this with a potential client. We've got some meetings in a couple of weeks' time about what can we do, roll this sort of thing out, is it's all very well as you as a consultant coming in and getting that idea, you know, that information out. You leave and the people are left behind who basically bared all and that's it. And I said in that, you know, and I brought exactly that point. I wouldn't roll this out until the senior leadership team had got it. And in a presentation a couple of weeks ago at the Defense Diving Symposium talking about learning teams. And I said, you know, here's some gotchas. If you go there and it needs to be a stratification across the organization to get the different perspective, because it's really easy to blame up into an organization. The operators go, bloody hell, management execs. They don't get it. And it's like, do you understand their constraints and their space that they're operating in as well? So, but I said to, you know, these senior officers, senior leaders, I said, if you hear stuff, you have to stifle your frustrations. You can't just go, you did what?
Yeah.
Because that's it. It's over. And that story will go out really quickly and all of your intelligence will just disappear. It'll be driven under the carpet and you'll never find out what's going on.
Yeah,
but we've got a reporting system. Irrelevant.
Exactly. Oh, we need to learn. We need to improve. We need to develop. We need to innovate. We need to do all these things. And we need to punish people who do things that we think is incorrect. Well, guess what? You can't do both. You're going to have to give some leeway somewhere online. And it brings me back. I'm about to release as well. Develop and release. I've had this idea around this for the past 3-4 years, and I've spoken to other people about it, and they've they've never picked up on it. And I wondered why, because my ego took a bit of a battering. If they haven't picked up on it, then maybe it's no good, but maybe they just don't recognize it. So I'm going to do it anyway. It's going to be free handout, which is going to be take five for leaders for when they hear bad news.
Yeah.
Because we have take fives for people at the front end for when the situation changes, the task is, or the environment or something on those lines, but we don't have any supportive mechanism or materials for leaders when their situation changes, when their task changes, when they hear bad news, when something changes in their environment. And I truly believe on
that. Yeah, it's really cool. Yeah.
I truly believe that the individual leader needs supporting just as much as the frontline leader does, because we, as you alluded to just then, everyone's got their own context, their own pressures, their own job demands, their own resources. Everyone is under pressure, and everyone either blames up or they blame down. What we need to do is kind of go, it's not blame, it's have recognition for each position from each opposing position. They're busy, they've got lots going on. How can I make this information easy for them to hear? From the top, I'm busy, but they're also at the sharp end. Their life is on the line. How do I make it easier for them to tell me what they need? It's a two-way stream. And if you have opposing powers going each way, if you have north and north, you're not going to smush them together. You need to have north and south so they attract and they work together properly. So I'm going to develop that. I think that'd be great.
Cool. That is a really good
idea. I'm
going
to give it all out for free. For anyone who wants to.
Well, why not? And it's one of the things that I sort of try to emphasize is that we talk about this work as imagine work is done at a sharp end. But middle managers, senior managers, executive teams also have gaps between what should be done and what gets done for a whole bunch of reasons, very similar to the frontline operators. Yeah. They're managing those tensions between productivity, between finance, and between sort of acceptable performance or safety. And one of the things that the hardest parts for senior leaders is the, I'm going to say the gestation period for failure modes in their decisions. So as a sharp end worker, when something happens, it's quite obvious here and now that's what's happened. But actually a decision that might be taken a year ago, 2 years ago, and made absolute sense at that stage because of the trade-offs that were going on, then actually we end up creating a terrible situation now. And it's very easy to go, well, they should have known. It's like, can you tell me what you're going to do in 2 years' time when it comes to a project? Yeah, well, we've got like risk assessments and these. It's like, yeah, right. That's not the reality. So it's creating that continuous learning culture that basically says, this is not going to plan. And, you know, previous guest, Ben Catania, just talking about encouraging them to listen to those signals that are coming from the floor and sitting there going, things have changed. The status is not where it was before. We probably need to relook at that. You know, how often do risk assessments at a project level, at a program level, get revisited when things change at the sharp end?
Very rarely. And I agree with you on that delay as well. I mean, it's the same in personal life and politics as well. I mean, we can make decisions on a personal level in our personal lives, and we get feedback.
Yeah.
We can get feedback relatively quickly. If you're a politician and you make wide sweeping systemic social changes, you might not hear for 3, 4, 5, 10, 15 years on the negative effects of that. You need to make damn sure that these wide-sweeping global or organization-wide initiatives that you're implementing, they if they do have negative side effects, and they likely will do, then there's systems and processes and procedures in place to be able to pick that up, review it, try and mitigate it, and at least learn from it and implement ongoing changes.
Yeah.
Because very unlikely you're going to get it right, but our ego tells us we can because we've got this degree, we've got that experience, we know this person, we know that person, these people think I'm great, and I know what I'm doing. But there's a reason so many senior safety leaders move on quite rapidly within a senior level, because it catches up with them quite after 12, 24, 36 months.
So the system design So in the military, certainly in the UK, where people have got postings of 2 or 3 years, 3 years maximum. If you're in the sort of the promotion prospects, all you need is two reports to then move on. So actually, in terms of productive time in job, you're talking about 1 year to 15 months, and it's like, can I do something in this period? Yeah, and it's like, did it cool, move on next. And you may move into a job, open the book and go, oh my God, all of this stuff here? Right, can I hide it for 2 years before I'm then out? And you say, well, that's really cynical. It's like, well, but that's also human nature. What do you reward people for? We reward people for not having bad outcomes, or we have reward them for good outcomes. So if you can hide something and you move on, that's not my problem anymore. And that's very simple, but that's unfortunately where we are as humans. So
Or if you can bring new changes in straight away and go, I can solve these problems with all these new things and I'll implement them all over the next 12 months and then I won't be around to see the results.
yeah, I've saved your money in the short term, and we reward short termism, unfortunately. So,
We do.
David, thank you very much for your time. The final sort of section is a recommendation of a paper, a book, or a video that you sort of really, and you can't have your own podcast because we'll put that in the show notes anyway. So, something that you have found as quite enlightening, doesn't have to be in the safety space. Can just be in, I've had a couple of really interesting books forecast or suggested. So go for it. What do you recommend people go and watch or read?
See, this was the hardest part of preparing for this, I've got to be honest with you, because I already knew about the incident. I knew what was going on. I knew where they'd messed up. I could talk about the detail and all that kind of stuff, but having a book or an article or a video is kind of like every week, it seems at the moment, I have something and I go, I've got post-it notes all over my wall. I'm writing a book at the moment, an actual book at the moment, through publisher through CRC Press in London. They've
Okay,
commissioned a book
cool.
from me. Yeah, they've commissioned a book from me, and that's going to be
Awesome.
ready. So I've got all these articles and post-it notes, hundreds of post-it notes all over the wall, and things of inspiration all over.
You
And
know,
I'm
there is some
like,
software called Scrivener that might help you with that.
I don't. I'd like. I'm old school. I like writing it down, putting it where I can see it all the time, and then I, by osmosis, I'll come up with a solution. That's my plan anyway, which very rarely works. Anyway.
Excellent.
So I'm like, oh, damn you, Gareth. Okay. And I don't want to give a bog standard answer that, because I'm guessing a lot of safety people are going to be watching this as well. So what I've picked is my niche area, which is safety coaching, organizational coaching, and the books that I've chosen. The first one is a book called The Coaching Habit.
The coaching habit. Okay.
Yeah, by a guy called Michael Bungay
Yep.
Stannier. I'll send you the link afterwards.
Yeah,
He's
please. Yeah, that'd be good. We'll put them in the show notes.
he was, I believe he's Canadian. He got Coach of the Year in Canada. This book sold over 1 million copies, and it's great. I read it in one sitting, and I'm not a very good reader, to be honest with you, even though I'm studying, and all that kind of stuff still. I do like reading, but I'm not a very good reader. I read this entire book in one sitting. And the reason being
Okay.
is because it's fabulous. It's fabulous. If you're a leader and you want to learn 7 simple steps on how to implement coaching style leadership in your organization so that you can learn more from your people, which is what we want in safety, this is the book for you. It's even like, it's called The Coaching Habit. Say less, ask more, and change the way you lead forever. It's an amazing book. He's
Cool.
got several books. Another book called, I can't remember what the other book's called, but they're all great. But that's a fabulous book. And I've got one more book, if I can share that.
Go for it. Yeah, go for it.
So this other book is by Marcia Reynolds called Coach the Person, Not the
Ah,
Problem. Now, this
interesting.
is a book because when we talk about coaching,
It's well flagged up by the looks of things.
exactly. When I talk about coaching to people, and when people talk about coaching, they think, oh, yeah, AFL coaching, soccer coaching, all that kind of stuff. And what are the benefits of it, and how can we do it in business? And why would you want to do it in business? This book answers all of those questions. It explains what organizational coaching really is, sure. its foundations, where it's from, the psychological benefits, and why coaches don't need to understand the problem. They need to understand the person that they're talking to. It's because coaching, organizational mm-hmm. coaching, isn't about people being there to solve people's problems for them, which is what I term in one of my blog posts, like a sugar fix.
Yeah.
That's not what they're there for. They're there to enable and to give the person resilience and to give the person the confidence that they've got the solutions within themselves. And even if they don't, if they don't think they do, there are ways in which we can work with you.
I'm doing some coaching with somebody, and it was really cool yesterday. A friend of theirs said to them, "I don't know what's been happening, but you look much better now." And to me, that was a really cool bit because, you know, I'm must be having an effect of some sort on my coachee, who is then presenting themselves differently to the world in a way that somebody else can pick up. So, yeah, it's really cool. It's really cool just about shifting their approach to how they view the world.
Yes.
So thank you for those recommendations.
No worries at all. And hopefully they are... some recommendations that you won't have had and that you hopefully won't have.
They're good.
They'll be unique out there as well. So
excellent. David, thank you very much for your time. It's really good. We'll catch up with you soon. Thanks very much. Take care.
No worries. Cheers, mate.